So much, Alex, for the introduction. Indeed, today you're going to hear about how to get the most out of a black hole. And by the most, I mean not just in terms of energy or magnetic fields or in terms of NSERC, NASA, or NSF grant money, but also in terms of fun, because black holes are fun. When I was a small kid, I was smashing toy cars together and they were flying apart, and that's what black holes do for us. As blobs of gas fall into the deep gravitational potential wells of the black hole, they accelerate, they shock against each other, they heat up, and they produce copious amounts of photons. And not only black holes do this, they also produce magnificent relativistic jets that you can see in this figure. So these are the two of my favorite examples of active galaxies, or active galactic nuclei, AGN as they are called. This is a Cygnus A galaxy. We see the active galactic nucleus at the center, and it produces two very well collimated streams of material that end up in luminous radio lobes. M87 galaxy has two jets. One of them we don't see because its radiation is beamed away from us. These jets are moving very close to the speed of light, and so the emission goes mostly along the direction of the jet, and this jet is pointing toward us, and so we see its emission. And both of the jets also end with these so-called ears, some people call them. So what we think is going on in the centers of these galaxies, we think that there are a few billion solar mass black holes sitting there, and this is an artist's depiction. There is a black hole in the center, there is gas that's trying to fall into it. It's orbiting around the black hole in the form of a disk, and it's the combination of a black hole and the disk that work together to produce this beautiful collimated outflows. The photons that the disk emits and the jets, they play important roles in shaping the growth of structure on cosmological scales and the galaxies. And so it's really important to understand what determines the power of the emission from the center of the galaxies and the jets. If we zoom in closer from a scale of 3,000 light years to a scale of a mere one light year, and this is just 1,000 black hole radii, you can see structure moving away from the center of the galaxy, from the nucleus. So we think that jets are formed in the immediate vicinity of the black hole, and they carry away the information about the strong field gravity where they are formed to much larger distances where you can easily make images of them, which makes jets really attractive as probes of strong field gravity. How do we know if jets move fast or not? Well, we can see that. Here I show a series of snapshots taken at intervals of about a year or two of an active galaxy 3C to 79. And you can see that there is a structure that's also moving away from the black hole. You can draw a straight line through the positions of the jet component and measure its slope, and the apparent velocity with which this component moves in the sky exceeds the speed of light by a factor of 4. This is a very clear and well-known signature of intrinsically relativistic motion. So even though this component is moving faster than the speed of light on the sky, it doesn't mean that the actual underlying motion has to be faster than the speed of light. It just has to approach the speed of light and be very close to it. In fact, the intrinsic velocity of this jet is thought to be 99.7% of the speed of light. So it's a very relativistic motion. We also happen to be very lucky because in this galaxy, the jet happens to point almost directly at us. And therefore, most of its emission, as I mentioned, would be beamed into our line of sight, which makes this object much brighter than it would be otherwise. And this jet shines on all frequencies. And we can see, since these jets are like laser beams going through space, we can see these galaxies out to very large distances. For instance, in the case of this galaxy, this is a spectrum. This is the flux versus frequency. And I will walk you through different parts of the spectrum. We can see it in the radio band, for instance, with an ALMA telescope that is ramping up its operations in the southern hemisphere. We can see jets in infrared optical and UV. Oh, I'm sorry for breaking the property. In infrared optical and UV with ground-based and space-based telescopes such as Hubble. And we can see it in X-rays with Chandra, XMM, Newton, and the recently launched high-energy telescope NuSTAR. We also can see it in even higher energy photons in gamma rays with the Swift and Fermi telescopes, and with the ground-based Cherenkov telescopes at the very high energy TeV gamma rays. So black holes talk to us in a variety of ways across the whole spectrum, but that's not the whole story. We also think that black holes produce high energy cosmic rays, and they also produce neutrinos potentially, as well as gravitational waves if the two black holes come together and merge. So having all these diagnostics of our one single patient, a black hole, can be overwhelming. Really, in order to try and understand what all these observations are telling us, it would be really good to take a black hole, put it in the gravity room here, throw some mass at it with magnetic fields, and see what it does. If it produces a jet, great. We will vary the parameters of the system, and we will compare them to the observations, and we will know what are the actual parameters of the black holes. We can probe gravity in the universe by comparing what we have in our lab to the universe. There is one slight problem, though. We can't put a black hole in the gravity room. Perimeter Institute wouldn't allow that. So what do we do? Well, this is what my talk is about. In order to make sense of all of this, in order to learn about the black holes, in order to understand how powerful their feedback on large-scale structure formation is, we actually need to carry out detailed modeling. We have to have an experiment inside of our computer. That's what we can do. That's what we can do, and that's what Perimeter Institute would allow us to do. So let us move on and see what kind of black holes are there, and what kind of black holes produce jets. It turns out not only the big guys produce jets, as I mentioned, the active galactic nuclei, such as the M87 with the black hole of mass of about 5 billion solar masses. In general, such active galactic nuclei, quasars as they also called, have masses of black holes that range between a million and billions of solar masses. So what we have here is the black hole and the disk, and they work together to produce a jet. The same exact thing happens for smaller black holes, so-called microquasars or stellar mass black holes. Their masses range from maybe 5 solar masses to tens of solar masses, and the same thing happens. We have a companion star orbiting a stellar mass black hole. The companion loses mass in the form of a disk that falls into the black hole, and again, we have a jet. Exactly the same structure on small scales happens in these exotic objects called core collapse gamma ray bursts, or long duration gamma ray bursts, where the core of the star exhausts its fuel and collapses into a black hole. The rest of the star forms an accretion disk, and again, bingo, we have a couple of jets that pierce the envelope, emerge, and radiate high energy photons. And if those jets happen to point straight at us, we see a gamma ray flash in the sky called the gamma ray burst. There are other types of gamma ray bursts that come from mergers of binary systems, black hole neutron star or potential neutron star, which are also interesting. I just don't show them here. And the black hole here is about 5 solar masses or so, give or take a factor of few. So these jets are everywhere. They are telling us about the physics that is happening very close to the black hole. For all, these jets push through the whole envelope and taught us something about it. It would be really nice to have a good idea of what's going on at the center. So what are the fundamental questions that I will try to address at least partially in this talk? Well, we see these jets. They carry energy out. They mess up the whole structure of a galaxy potentially, and they change the properties of large-scale formation. So is there any maximum upper limit to jet power? That's a very fundamental question that I would like to get the answer for. All right, so fine, we have a jet, we measured its power. What does it tell us about the central engine? Where does the power come from in the first place? Does it come from the rotation of the black hole itself or from the inner regions of accretion disk that surround the black hole? That's a very important one that we need to understand in order to know how jet power connects to the properties of the black hole. Well, imagine the first scenario, that it is the black hole rotation that powers the jets. Well, if the black hole spins faster, presumably it will give away more power. Therefore, if we see a more powerful jet, presumably the black hole span faster. Spinned faster. If it is the inner regions of the accretion flows that power the jets, then a similar thing happens. Even though it's counterintuitive. The faster the black hole spins, the closer in the inner edge of the disk comes to the black hole, the deeper levels of gravitational potential it probes, and the more powerful the outflow from the disk would be. So we expect to have the same relationship, but the shape will probably be different. So we need to understand both. It's a hard, complicated question. how the jet power will depend on black hole spin, but the one that we would like to address. Another important question in the cosmological context is what happens to black hole spins as they eat up mass? Do they spin up to almost maximal spin because the black hole, if it eats mass from an accretion disk that orbits in the same direction, will inevitably be getting more and more and more angular momentum? Will it be always spun up to the maximum spin or not? It turns out the answer is no. It can actually be slowed down to zero. This is a very interesting recent result that I hopefully will have time to mention. Finally, importantly, in galaxies, in other systems, you do not always expect the black hole axis to coincide with the axis of the angular momentum of the material that falls into the black hole. So-called tilted accretion disks are thought to be quite common in galaxies and in other events. What will happen to the black hole spin in that case? And which way will the jet point? Can we know which direction black hole spins are by looking, pointing by looking at the jet directions? So these are the bullet points that I would like to address. And in order to address them, we would like to have an experiment on a computer. And what are the required components that we need to simulate, model, in order to properly, faithfully represent nature? Well, what are we dealing with? Sorry, I will have to switch to this because I'm a little bit too short for the screen. So we will have an accretion disk around a black hole. And we will have a black hole in the center and the jet that the black hole produces. So in order to simulate the disk, we would need to address the physics that is responsible for it reaching the black hole. Because imagine that a disk was a bunch of non-interacting particles. They would always, forever, circle around the black hole, conserving their mass and energy, and these disks wouldn't shine. So we need to have some viscosity in these accretion disks that would bring mass towards the black hole. We need gas to lose angular momentum. And we think that magnetic field is what does this for us. Magnetic field in a shear of an accretion flow is unstable due to so-called magnetorotational instability that was rediscovered recently by Balbus and Holly only in 1991. It was conceived first by Chandrasekhar much earlier, but in the astrophysical content, the so-called MRI, magnetorotational instability, was only realized to be important much more recently. And this instability causes turbulence and viscosity in the accretion flow. In order to faithfully represent the magnitude of viscosity that this turbulence causes, you need to resolve small turbulent length scales in the accretion flow. And also the nature of this instability is fully three-dimensional, so you have to carry a three-dimensional simulation. You cannot just assume axisymmetry. So that makes the problem already hard. So we need to do three-dimensional magneto-hydrodynamic simulations. You cannot just do hydrodynamic, you need to include magnetic fields. All right, so that's the disk. What about the jet? Well, the jets are not easy either. Why is that? Well, it's because the jets are made of magnetic fields, mostly. That's what allows them to accelerate to large velocities. And what do I mean by made of magnetic fields? If I were to compare the jet energy and magnetic field component, it would be maybe 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times greater than the rest mass energy of a jet. The mass of the stuff that the jet is that sits in the jet times the c squared, c being the speed of light. Why is that hard to study? Let me give you an example. Let's say this from here to here is the magnetic component of the jet, energy-wise. And from here to there is the rest mass component of the jet. This is much bigger than that. And let's say that we evolve the total energy, that's what we want to conserve, but we make a small error in it, 10% error, just like that. While that error is small compared to the total energy budget, it's huge. It's of order of the rest mass energy budget of the jet. And therefore, if we make such a small error relative to the total energy content, it will be really catastrophic for the rest mass energy. Our mass will start flying along the magnetic field less uncontrollably. So we need to have a robust numerical scheme that doesn't make such big errors, and we need to have a lot of resolution in the jet region. So we need to have a lot of resolution in the disk, in the jet. What else? What else do we have? What else do black holes have for us? Radiation. right? Did I mention that the black hole accretion disks shine? And if they shine a lot, then this radiation can dramatically change the structure of the accretion flow. For instance, radiation pressure can turn around gas that would otherwise fall directly into the black hole and swing it away, thereby depriving the black hole of its fuel. And therefore, radiation should also be included. So what are we dealing with here? We need to include radiation, black hole, the general relativity, magnetohydrodynamics, and it has to be done in three dimensions. So we need to carry out 3D radiation general relativistic MHD studies of these systems in order to solve the whole system from first principles. Is this easy or hard? Well, let's see. General relativistic effects require you to keep the whole metric in your simulation. And you have to use this metric to measure distances as you carry the simulation out, which requires a lot of floating point operations. And radiation adds another extra layer of complexity. So even without radiation, these simulations are at least 5 times more expensive than what you would carry out if you were interested only in non-relativistic aspects, standard motions in flat space. So that is why it's hard. In addition, another degree of complexity here is that we need to carry out global simulation that contains the disk out to large distances and jet out to large distances, but also resolves local small-scale microphysics in the disk and in the jet. It's a multi-scale problem. It would be so much easier if we just had a patch of the disk to deal with, and some people do so, or some people just study a patch of the jet. But to have the whole shebang on the grid and resolve the small scales requires you having a lot of small grid cells all over the place. So this is why this problem is hard. Another way of looking at this is that time scales at large distances are very long. Time scales at short distances are very short. And your time step is determined by the short time scales. So you have to make many, many, many time steps in order to evolve the system such that the disk will even orbit once at large distances. And that's where you want to get your mass. Please. Metric is non-dynamical. That is something you could include as well. It's Kerr. But you can put any metric you want. Right now, I will be just putting Kerr in, but there could be Johansson metrics. Yes, you can put all that in without any problem. For the applications that I'm showing here, metric changes are not important. If you have two black holes merging, yes, but I will not be touching upon that. Yeah.
So why is TR MST 5 times more expensive than MST?
Well, it's just what it comes out to be. It's just a measurement. So I know how fast the MHD is and how fast the GR MHD is, and we can tell what the difference in speed is. But the origin of the increase in the complexity of the computations comes down to the fact that you now have to distinguish between contravariant and covariant vectors. And you have many components of the metric to raise and lower them. So basically, the number of components, more terms in your equations makes it more expensive. So I need to do something here before I go and start simulating this, because one simulation takes already 100 CPU years just without including radiation. So let me simplify my life for now, and I will cross out the radiation from my consideration if my laptop agrees with me. So I will leave this for the future. I will get back to it at the end of the talk. So far, I will assume that radiation effects are not important. And I will proceed with considering black hole, magnetic fields, hydrodynamics in 3 dimensions. That's enough to capture a lot of rich physics already, as you will see in a moment. All right, so what am I going to be talking about in a moment? I'm going to be showing you movies of how mass gets in the black hole and how jets are launched. But before that, I wanted to give you a brief Jets 101. How are jets produced? How do they work? Even though black hole has no surface, let me for a second forget about that and say that this perfectly conducting sphere represents a black hole. It spins at a frequency omega And I have an initially vertical field line, which is attached by one end to the surface of the sphere. By the other end, it's attached to the ceiling, which is meant to represent the ambient medium. And let us wait for n rotations of the sphere. What will happen? The initially vertical field line will develop n toroidal loops, one loop per each rotation. And there is toroidal pressure, b phi squared over 8 pi, associated with these loops. So the poor ceiling, the ambient medium, is experiencing a push. If we wait for a little bit longer, more loops form, and eventually the ceiling gives in, and the magnetic spring that we have twisted by the rotation of the central object expands vertically under the action of its own pressure and picks up any gas that sits on the field line and accelerates it. This is a complex process that has been studied by many people, including myself. And it's really important to understand it in order to connect this to the observational, observed quantities, like the gamma rays, neutrinos, and cosmic rays that are thought to be given away by the jets. And many, many, many people have worked here on this problem. This complex acceleration process, though, can be thought of in an easier way. We can imagine that the initially vertical field line is continuously reprocessed by the rotation of the central object into toroidal field loops, so that these loops emerge from the central object at a certain rate, slide down our original field line, and expand laterally. And as they do so, the pressure drops, and the pressure gradient pushes these loops out and accelerates them. And if there is any gas attached to these loops, any plasma, it will be also accelerated. This is how jets work. This is very similar to the picture of a standard hydrodynamic nozzle, supersonic nozzle, where the cross-section of a nozzle expands. As the gas leaves the nozzle, its cross-sectional area expands. The density and pressure of the gas drops, and the pressure gradient pushes the gas out. Here, however, there is a complication. Pressure in the magnetic case is not a scalar, it's a tensor. So that tensorial nature can be thought of an additional force component of tension of these loops, which prevents the expansion and slows the jets down and makes the whole analysis more complex. So what I'm going to be talking a lot in the rest of the talk is what determines the power of these jets. And it turns out it's very simple. There are only two parameters, essentially, that determine the power of the jets. It's the flux phi, the number of field lines that are threading the black hole horizon, and the angular frequency of the black hole horizon, which I will call omega sub h, which is essentially the black hole spin A, which changes between 0 and 1, 0 non-spinning black hole, 1 is maximally spinning black hole, c is the speed of light, 2 is a number, and rh is the radius of the black hole horizon, which is essentially independent of black hole spin by astrophysical standards. It changes by a factor of 2 as you spin the black hole from 0 to maximal spin. So what we really have here is that omega h is basically the black hole spin, give or take a factor of 2, which we will forget for practical purposes here. So now we have power that depends on phi, the flux, and the omega. How would it depend on them? Clearly, the more flux we fit through the black hole, the more power we get out. So it's got to be that phi comes in some positive power. The same thing about omega. The faster the black hole spins, the more power we get. And what is the power in which these two enter? Well, if we flip the direction of either of them, the sign, we should get the same thing out. Therefore, it has to be in a square. That's what we get. Yeah, sure. You're absolutely right. But I have the square, so that's what I had to say, right? So in fact, that's what we get. You're absolutely right. It could be the fourth, and there will be a fourth, but this is the leading term. There's no linear term, that's the point. So the power is some coefficient that we understand really, really well. The square of the black hole flux, the square of the black hole angular frequency. And this wasn't apparent from the start. There was a lot of work that went into trying to understand this. In fact, there are corrections at higher order, which become important at very, very high spin, which we will forget for the purposes of this talk. And let me ask you now, if we measure the black hole jet power, we can divide this power by the prefactor and obtain the black hole spin. Why haven't we done so for all the jet-producing systems? Any volunteers? Well, it would be all great, but we have no idea what the black hole flux is. It's very hard to measure. It's down there near the black hole. We cannot make an image of it. We can try and make measurements, but still, they are highly uncertain. So how strong the field is on the black hole is up for grabs. We know this prefactor very well, within 10%, theoretically. Huh?
I guess maybe based on your simulations.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, actually, the prefactor itself was derived by Blandford Zanike, 1977. And then the fact that it was proportional to the square of frequency rather than the spin is what was realized much later. So how does this? This is essentially expansion in the powers of omega h. And you can expand in different quantities. You can expand in terms of black hole spin, in terms of black hole angular frequency of the horizon. And it turns out that this is the right expansion. It captures most of the dependence. If you expand it, say, in powers of spin, you would be a factor of 4 off at high speed. But this is details. So what I will say is that it doesn't really matter for the purpose of this talk what the prefactor is. So let me just forget about it. So what we care about is that power of the jet is proportional to this, the product of flux squared times the angular frequency of the black hole squared. Let me massage it and make it more theoretical looking. Let's divide both sides by the rate at which mass energy is accreted by the black hole. M dot c squared. M dot is how many grams per second has been consumed by the black hole, and c squared is the square root of the speed of light. So here we get something that is dimensionless. It's dimensionless jet power, or jet efficiency. And on the right, we get similarly dimensionless magnetic flux. I divided by the square root of accretion rate and the square of the black hole's magnetic black hole angular frequency. So let me give you an intuitive understanding of what this guy is. It's black hole energy investment efficiency. Let's say you have, Niyaish, you have $100, and you're thinking what to do with them. And I come here and I say, Niyaish, why don't we come to the black hole? And since energy is money and energy is mc squared, it's mass, so we can convert this money into mc squared and drop it into the black hole and see how much comes back out in terms of jet power. And let's say $20 come back out. Niyaish doesn't talk to me anymore after that. But remember this 20% value. It will come up just in a few lines. But let's say another scenario. We take $100, drop it into the black hole, and $140 comes back out. If $140 comes back out, I think not only Niyaish, but all of you will start talking to me. So please do come talk to me after the talk, because this is what I'm going to show you is possible. $140 does come back out. So, well, it's science. I can show it to you. Good. Discussion is good. So people, of course, try to study what this efficiency is, because if you know the efficiency, you can measure jet power, and then you can measure the spin of the black hole. All general relativistic MHD simulations have found powers no higher than only 20%. Is this a fundamental upper limit to jet power? Can you get more out? Why would it be 20%? Does it have to be 20%? Is there a fundamental reason to it? Remember the 20% value? You wouldn't talk to me. In fact, in nature, some active galactic nuclei seem to have powers greater than 100%. Does this mean that there is something missing about our fundamental understanding of what's going on at small scales? Or are the observations incorrectly interpreted? Is it at all possible, as Niyaish is asking me, to get more than what you put in? Sounds good to be true. The extra energy would have to come from somewhere. We don't have a free pie here. So this is the question that I would like to address. So let's look. The answer is here. What should we do in order to try and probe the maximum power? Well, the black hole spin is a given, let's say. We want to probe maximum power as a function of spin. So we've fixed this guy. What about the flux? We really need to try and see what's the maximum possible value of the magnetic flux on the black hole. What is the maximum possible value of phi? And how do we do this? Well, let's try and stuff the black hole with as much flux as possible. What is the natural upper limit to that? Well, here I drew a black hole, I threaded it with some magnetic field lines, and I put a disk around. I don't show the disk on the left. It's a slice through the black hole and disk rotational axis. So the disk is like a donut that's sticking out from the board. The disk can happily accrete as long as there is weak magnetic field. If the magnetic field is very strong, its push, its magnetic force, Fb, F sub b, will overcome the force of gravity that keeps the field together on the black hole, and the field will just push the disk away. So the maximum field strength that we can have in a black hole is such that it's as strong as gravity, but not stronger. If the field strength is stronger than gravity, the disk is dispersed by the forces of magnetic fields. So how do we formalize this? Even in this very simple way, force of magnetic field is less than the force of gravity. Well, the force of magnetic field is the pressure of the magnetic field times the area of a sphere, roughly 4 pi r squared for some distance, for a black hole horizon radius. And there is a force acting on the inner disk that's keeping it together by the force of gravity of the black hole. The gravitational constant, times the black hole mass, times the mass of the disk within a few gravitational radii, divided by the radius. That's all there is to it. This is the basic physics. And we can massage this relation and back out what the maximum field strength that enters here, such that the disk is not dispersed away by the black hole magnetic field. And it turns out to be quite realistic. It's 10 to the 4 Gauss for those who study active galactic nuclei. For reasonable accretion rates, this is a luminosity in Eddington units, the mass of the black hole in the units of billions of solar masses. This is what you operate on. So this is not crazy. These fields can happen, and actually we think they do happen in nature. So what happens if the black hole magnetic field reaches this value? Well, we get a magnetically arrested disk, or a MAD. In this case, the black hole magnetic flux is maximum, and since power is proportional to flux squared, black hole jet power is also maximum. So we're probing the most powerful jets in the universe that presumably make the most mess of the surroundings. So it's really important to understand how that works. And in this case, the magnetic field is limited by the gravity of the black hole acting on the inner accretion disk. So how do we go mad? How do we get a magnetically arrested disk? Well, we need to flood the black hole with as much magnetic flux as possible. So how do we do this? Well, we carry out numerical experiments with a numerical general relativistic MHD code HARM, don't be scared. It stands for High Accuracy Relativistic Magnetohydrodynamics. And these simulations are quite long. They took overall about a few thousand CPU years. But as you see, I've kept pretty well, even though my hair is starting to come out. And of course, it's possible to do because we're running these simulations on thousands of cores at the same time. So we can complete them over time scales of a year or so. So it's really exciting. This is a new MAD mode of accretion that has really high jet power, much more powerful than people ever thought was possible. It is interesting also in the fact that what is responsible for angular momentum transport in the accretion flow is not the standard magnetorotational instability that people believed is responsible for that. Actually, magnetorotational instability is suppressed, and I will not cover this in the talk, but it's really interesting to understand what is responsible for the transport of angular momentum, and we think it's large-scale magnetic stresses and the outflows that take away the angular momentum from the disk. So let me show you how we do this. This is a window through which you're looking at the numerical simulation. It's 400 gravitational radii on the side. The black hole is this dot at the center. Its axis is pointing up, and so is the accretion disk axis. And initially, we need to put some reservoir of mass around the black hole. That's what's going to accrete, and that's a donut of mass that is initially in perfect equilibrium. If we were to leave it there, it would sit forever. But what we do, we mess it up a little bit. We put a very weak magnetic field. That magnetic field is dynamically completely non-important. Its pressure is less than 1% of thermal pressure of the accretion flow. But as I mentioned, this field is unstable to the magnetorotational instability. And you will see that this will cause accretion of the gas in the black hole. So how is all this different than what people have done before? I'm not the first one who got into this game. Well, I challenge you to tell me, what's the difference, one single most important difference between this initial condition that has been standard and was used by, for instance, these people, and what I'm doing now? Who can tell me? What's the most single important difference between this and that? Nayesh, but look, of course it's the color scheme. Look, this blue is darker, and this red is much darker, and the field lines are shown in white here and here in the black. But
you didn't tell us what the colors are.
But you are absolutely right in both points. Of course, it's the size that matters, and the colors here mean the rest mass density. Thank you, Niaish. It's great. Great question. So blue is low density. It's 1 million times less dense than the red. And it's a logarithmic color scale, which I will show you in the next slide. But what's really crucial here is that the size of the initial conditions that was used previously was really tiny. And since you don't want to put too strong of a magnetic field there, the area of the disk was much smaller than what we can do now. And therefore, now we can put much more magnetic flux there. We can win because of the area, not because of the field strength. And therefore, we can flood the black hole with magnetic flux. So let me zoom into the very central region here and blow it up. This is the inner region. The color scale is shown here. It's logarithm of density. It's raw. It's cut off here. And red is a unity density. And blue is 10 to the minus 6. So what else here? It's a box of 100 gravitational radii on the side. This is the vertical cross section through the rotational axis of the black hole and of the disk. And this is a horizontal cross section. So we cut it along the equator and look from above. The black hole here is spinning counterclockwise, and so does the disk counterclockwise. Just to show you that this is not a pretty movie, but an actual physical simulation which we can learn things from. We have mass accretion rate as a function of time, which is measured in light crossing times of the black hole. We run the simulation for a very long time, 30,000 light crossing times. That's very long. The flux on the black hole and the power of the jets. So let me run it and see what happens. First, these field lines shown in black, this magnetic field becomes unstable due to the magnetorotational instability. The fields are sheared, amplified, cause turbulence to form, and you can see the turbulent eddies forming the disk starting to accrete because of the turbulent viscosity caused by the magnetorotational instability. You can see mass crossing the black hole horizon. So m dot, the mass accretion rate, is non-zero. The flux on the black hole increases function of time. These dots show the current position in time and the value of the quantity we are watching. And also the jet power goes up. Jet power, after all, is the square of magnetic flux. So this tracks that up to a square. As we wait longer and longer, more and more flux collects at the center. Yes, correct. Yes. More and more flux collects at the center. And as you might have noticed, the disk was becoming thinner and thinner and thinner because the fields were squishing it vertically. And once the field becomes as important as the gravity acting on the disk, remember the previous slide, once B becomes greater than B max, the fields squeeze the disk into a current sheet, reconnect around the equator, and can break free away from the black hole. That's what happens. This shaking is happening because magnetic flux bundles are escaping the black hole into the disk. And since magnetic field is lighter than the surrounding gas, these fields raise buoyantly through the disk, like bubbles of air in the water. They raise up, and up here is away from the black hole, away, away, away. You can see every time a flux bundle is launched, and I will pause the simulation for a second to illustrate that, the flux drops on the black hole. It opens up room for more flux to come in because gas brings in flux. So there has to be an opening on the black hole for the new gas that brings flux to come in. And that's why the flux then restores itself to a normal value. But then some flux bundle gets kicked out from the black hole again. And so this is why you see these quasi-periodic oscillations of flux on the black hole. The key point here is that on average, the jet power shown with the dashed line, it exceeds 100%. It's 140%. As long as we could run the simulation, we stopped at 30,000 dynamical times, which is much longer than any simulation that was run before this one. We get the average jet power of 140%. So you do get $140 on your $100 investment, Niyayish? Let's talk about this, okay? Yeah? Okay, good. Exactly right. It's coming from the black hole spin. And what's interesting, and that kept me up for a couple of nights, I thought I did something wrong. Black hole mass is actually going down. It's okay. It can go down. Entropy will stay the same at most or increase, but the mass can still go down. That's what happens. The black hole is actually getting lighter and lighter. We're sucking out the energy. And how can we do this? It's because the jets are so powerful. They suck out more energy per unit time than the whole rest mass energy supplied per unit time by the accretion flow. That's how you can get more out than what you put in. The extra comes from the black hole spin. Precisely right. So let me pause the simulation just for a second to illustrate. Yeah.
Yeah. So you said you start with a small magnetic field.
Weak magnetic fields relative to the gas pressure.
To the gas, but then it grows up as the gas.
Just because of the compression, is you start you take the flux from large area, you compress it to a very small area, and so the field strength goes up.
So then the claim is that this generically happens when you have accretion into black
hole. Absolutely true. Provided there is large scale magnetic flux. Actually, you don't have to have a strong flux. If you take a micro Gauss magnetic field strength, you take 100 parsec by 100 parsec patch of this of the galaxy, dump it on the black hole, you will get more flux than you would ever need. So it's not very much at all.
So is the claim that this is really the generic model accretion into black hole?
I would pose a question is, if this doesn't happen in many cases at least, it would be a problem because I do not see why it wouldn't happen.
Okay, so which cases don't you expect this to happen?
I would always expect that there would be a large amount of flux that would do this. In some cases, maybe there is no flux, somehow, no large scale flux, or the flux is unfavorably oriented, so it's not vertical, but horizontal. But it would require fine tuning. You would really want to have no mismatch at all.
For high Eddington ratio,
for high Eddington ratio, you're absolutely right. It will be, you will need more flux. So maybe the most powerful galaxies would have more trouble finding the flux, but low Eddington ratio galaxies would probably have more than ever want.
30,000.
No, it doesn't change. Yeah. Light crossing time of our center of galaxy is 30 seconds or so, like 1 minute. And so this would be, therefore, 30,000 minutes. For M87 galaxy multiplied by 1,000, this is not cosmological timescales. But I actually have computed simulations at different spins, so I can connect them and tell you how the spin would evolve. So that's actually one of the slides that I would like to get to. And let me go there. But before I do, I just wanted to illustrate this. So this is the vertical magnetic flux bundle that escaped from the black hole. Where you see strong magnetic field is a depression in density. It's yellow compared to red. Yellow is about 100 times less than red. So we have mostly flux here threading the disk and not much mass. If we look from above, we see that this is a flux bundle that has this sheared shape. So the fields are pointing out of the board here. And this flux is moving out because it's lighter than the surrounding fluid, and it's also been sheared around and mixed back into the accretion flow. That's the circulation of flux that you see in these simulations.
So in the actual simulation, you're saying it's a good approximation to keep the metric fixed.
Yes.
So
yes.
Can you check that the actual angle momentum falling into the black hole is the correct amount to account? I mean, is the clearest interpretation correct that it's actually
so. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we've checked that. So it's all consistent. Of course, we don't change the metric, but it's a good approximation, as you said. Yeah.
Maybe another version of this question. If you assume something like an accretion rate appropriate for M87,
yeah,
how much over your 30,000 microsecond times would the spin have changed? What fractional change in the spin?
Let me see. So 410 to the 8 years. This would be a year, 10 to the 8, divided by 4. It would be a quarter 10 to the minus 10, I think. Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. Good, let me move on. I have more stuff to show you. We can carry the simulations out for different spins. We can carry them for maximally rotating retrograde black holes. The spin that's negative shows that the black hole is spinning in the other direction than the disk. We can carry them for non-rotating black holes, spin equal to zero. This is the spin axis. And for maximally spinning black holes, or nearly maximally spinning black holes, spin of 0.99. This is the simulation data point that I show here. And this is the jet power. You can see that if the spin is greater than about 0.9, that is here, the jet power is greater than 100%. All those black holes that spin very fast, they lose net energy. This is actually the first demonstration ever that a black hole can lose net energy in a realistic astrophysical system. Before that, it wasn't clear, as an aside. So this is the total energy, both from the black hole component and from the disk component of the outflow. We can break it up into a component that comes from the black hole, so-called Blanford-Znaid component. These are the two guys who first quantified that power. And you can see that most of the power at high spins is actually coming from the black hole. The red and green curves are very similar. Near the zero point, when the black hole is not spinning, of course, the black hole cannot contribute anything because it doesn't spin. So here, the most of the contribution is made up by the disk contribution, which is shown in blue. And there again, Blanford and Payne, Blanford is everywhere, Blanford and Payne computed how that can depend on the properties of the disk. So here we can actually use the simulations to quantify the relative contribution of the disk and the black hole in powering the outflow. And you can see that at high spins, the black hole wins, at low spins, the disk wins. So this is the predictive power of the simulations. Yes?
How do you separate the two from
the easiest way to do so is to time average the simulation and connect the streamlines of energy to see if they connect to the black hole or to the disk. And that's how I separate the two. I can track where the energy is coming because I have it all in my lab on a computer, and I can make any measurement I want. So how is this different than what others have done? Well, this is the jet power that I measure. This is the jet power that was obtained by the previous studies. You can see that we get in many, 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 much more power than before. Actually, at intermediate spins, we have power that exceeds the previous studies by orders of magnitude. And if you now measure the jet power and try and read of the spin, you can see there is a huge difference between what the previous models would tell you and what, our models tell you. Because what we obtained is the upper limit to jet power for a given accretion disk thickness. Let me show you something else. These jets are really powerful. So power comes from accretion or maybe from the black hole spin, both actually. And therefore, you would expect that they would slow black holes down. How does the black hole spin change because of that energy loss? Well, this is what I try and quantify here on the plot. The horizontal axis is, again, the black hole spin. This is spin minus 1. This is 0. This is 1. This is maximally rotating prograde black hole. And here I show the spin-up parameter of the black hole. If it's positive, it means that the spin is going towards the positive side, it's increasing. If it's negative, the black hole spin is going towards the negative side, towards minus 1. So this is the spin up region shown in pink, and in the light green, the spin down region. And the standard thin disk, this is a standard model that is most often used to approximate accretion, tells you that the spin up parameter is always positive. It will spin you up to the maximal spin in a finite amount of time. And so the standard picture is that the black hole will always end up, if you accrete in the same direction, if the direction of angular momentum doesn't change in time, and will spin up to a spin of 0.9 or greater. However, this is the spin-up curve for MADS. Since the magnetic fields in MADS are so strong, they rob even the accretion flow of angular momentum, so what gets to the black hole is very little. So, and the jets slow the black holes down. So what we end up with is the zero crossing point where the black hole would be in spin equilibrium, where the spin doesn't change anymore, is essentially zero spin. The fact that it's 0.08 is irrelevant. What's important as opposed to 0.09 or 0.05, what's relevant is that this is essentially zero compared to one. MADS slow black holes down in a rather short time by cosmological measures to near zero spin. And that happens when the black hole increases its mass by about 30%. Increase black hole mass by 30%, boom, spin is zero, provided that it has this powerful jet. So that's really quite interesting and has important implications for cosmology. So let me finish up this talk by presenting to you results that you may have seen by John McKinney, myself, and Roger Blanford. What happens if you consider a system in which the black hole axis is misaligned compared to the angular momentum axis of the accretion flow? This is naturally happening if, let's say, a big galaxy, it's a satellite galaxy that comes from some random direction. Or it can happen if I'm the big black hole and there is a small star that's traveling around me in an orbit and comes too close and gets sheared up by my tidal gravity, gravity forces. Then the star is thrown out in a fan of material that starts to come back and forms an accretion disk that has a midplane that is oriented in a really weird direction compared to the spin of me, the black hole. So these simulations, they implement this misalignment in the following way. At first, we will have black hole spin pointing up and disks angular momentum axis also pointing up. It's a co-aligned system. And then in the middle of the simulation, we're going to take this black hole and put it on its side. Then we will suddenly have a black hole that is misaligned with the accretion flow. And we're going to see what happens to the jet. Will the jet survive? Will it not? So actually, can I switch up the light here? Thank you. So you can see the accretion flow in a yellow red. And you can see the jet in blue, and the jet is wobbling left and right. It's the same exact simulation as you saw in the previous slide. And the jet is wobbling because of the magnetic flux bundles accreted and expelled by the black hole. And soon we're going to put it on its side. The black hole is going to flip its spin from this orientation to that orientation. We just did this. See, at first the jet doesn't know what to do. It's lost. It tries to punch holes through the disk. But since the magnetic field is so strong, it's dynamically important in MADS, eventually the field wins. It reorients the accretion flow angular momentum near the black hole and the jet direction itself along the new direction of black hole spin. Now let me ask you, imagine I'm an observer sitting along the black hole spin axis right here. What am I going to see? I will be playing it again. The jet is moving up and down, it's wobbling, and it's like a laser pointer that's pointing in the direction, that's sending its photons in the direction of the jet. Therefore, if I'm an observer sitting along the direction through which the jet passes transiently, every time the jet passes transiently through the direction toward me, I will see a huge flare. Otherwise, I won't see the jet emission at all because it's all beamed along the jet direction. So let me play it once again. We just put the black hole on its side, and then the poor jet is wobbling between the original orientation and the new orientation of the jet. So if I'm an observer here, I'm going to see flares. And we think that we actually have seen this. Let me pause the movie so it doesn't distract. Let's say we're an observer here. Every time the jet would pass in front of us, we would see these huge flares. This is an interpretation of this event. I'll explain what the event is in a second. This is logarithmic scale of the number of photon counts or the flux in X-rays as a function of time. This time scale is 3 days. 1, 2, 3 days. And we see a few strong peaks by 2.5 orders of magnitude separated from the minimum. We think that what happened here, and this is an event with the phone number J1644 detected by the X-ray telescope SWIFT. And we think that it is a jet emission from a tidal disruption event. So black hole disrupted the star, as I was explaining earlier, and the accretion flow that followed caused production of a jet that was wobbling just like in our simulation and happened to be passing through our line of sight several times. Every time it passed through our line of sight, we saw a bright flare. And this is just one part of the interpretation. There are many other observational puzzles that are presented by this event that the picture of having a magnetically arrested accretion onto a tilted black hole can explain. This is just one aspect of it. If you're interested in this, come and talk to me. But this is really exciting. This is one of the most, I would say, direct and compelling lines of evidence that shows you that indeed magnetic layer rest of accretion is happening in a particular source. Let me now summarize. The central accumulation of magnetic flux, if there is enough of flux, will saturate the black hole with magnetic field and will lead to the formation of a MAD, magnetically arrested disk. These MADs, they have maximum efficiency in outflows as compared to any other disk because the magnetic flux on the black hole is maximum, and therefore the power of the jet, which is proportional to the flux squared, is also maximum. It's the first demonstration of net energy extraction of a black hole in a realistic astrophysical system. These MADs are potentially responsible for the most powerful jets in the universe. MADs, as you saw, align the direction of the jet in the direction of black hole spin, and potentially can explain many astrophysical systems, but in particular, the one that I showed you, Swift J1644, which is really a system of its kind. There was another one that was seen similarly, and there should be many more happening. These kinds of events are really important at probing otherwise dormant black holes. These black holes we wouldn't see otherwise, but as a star comes in, dumps a lot of mass on the black hole, we suddenly start seeing it. So this way we can probe black holes that otherwise are inaccessible to us. So what are we going to do next? Is this all that we can do? And that's, of course, not all we can do. It's only a beginning of a fully three-dimensional fun journey to black holes. And not only black holes, but also neutron stars. Because what I showed you, the techniques that can be used for black holes can be used also for neutron stars. Here I show a movie of a first three-dimensional relativistic MHD, magnetohydrodynamic simulation of a neutron star magnetosphere. And we can use such simulations to study many aspects that were previously not addressed. For instance, with graduate student Sasha Filipov at Princeton, we are studying how these magnetospheres apply torques on neutron stars. And what we are finding is that if a neutron star, which is a dipole, which is tilted compared to the rotational axis, how does this magnetosphere apply the torques on the neutron star such that maybe the direction of the dipole evolves? And we find that it's indeed true. In a lifetime of a pulsar, the dipole tends to drift towards the rotational axis. Therefore, pulsar inclination angles are evolving in time, which is quite interesting and affects results of pulsar population synthesis studies. You can study neutron star accretion, boundary layers, jets. You can study binary magnetospheres of neutron stars and black holes and neutron stars and neutron stars, which is important for computing the electromagnetic counterparts to gravitational wave sources. You can study a very important issue of how jets transfer the energy to the surroundings and impact the global structure, cosmological structure growth. Do the jets remain stable? We see in observations they do. How is it possible? It's an unresolved problem. Where does the magnetic flux come from? So far, I put the magnetic flux by hand in our simulations, assuming that the accretion flow was able to drag it in all the way to the black hole. But maybe it's impossible. Nobody has simulated how this flux gets in towards the black hole. So it's really important to connect to the very large scales, see how the small scales connect to the large scales, and maybe try and understand if magnetic flux can be generated in situ by the accretion flow. So this we already tried to address. The problem of dragging in the flux from large distances is very applicable to this tidal disruption event that I was talking to you about. And I'm working on a project with this with the Harvard graduate student Luke Kelly in the context of tidal disruption events. So as I mentioned, it's important to try and connect the small scales to the large scales. And it's a really computationally challenging problem because of the disparate timescales near the black hole and far away. So we need to try and improve our modeling techniques, possibly talking across the disciplines to weather modeling people and to engineering to try and implement the subgrid models that would allow us to not resolve the turbulent length scales in accretion flows, and thereby speed up the simulations. We can also use graphical processing units or GPUs to speed up the simulations, and that's what I'm going to do. Even more importantly, we are currently working on implementing the radiation into our GRMHD scheme. So we can now try and compute the spectra self-consistently and quantify the feedback that radiation can impart on the accretion flow, which has never been done in GRMHD for accretion disks. What we're doing for this is using so-called M1 radiation moments closure, which you don't need to know what it is. I'm just going to illustrate how it is different from the standard closures that people were using. This is a result of irradiation of an opaque blob of gas by a plain radiation wave from the left. And you can see that the blob casts a shadow as expected. But if you use a standard isotropic so-called Eddington closure that is usually used in general relativistic applications, you can see that rays can go around the black hole and there's no shadow that's formed. This is unphysical. We really want this. And this is what we're using together with John McKinney and Oleg Sadovsky. We can trace the beams of light, not just in flat space, but also they can be curved by black holes. This is, after all, our main application. Once we have radiation in our scheme, we will attack a lot of problems. And what I would love to do is to try and understand how much radiation can escape from disks that operate at near maximal luminosity. It's really unknown what's the fraction of photons that escape compared to how much mass the black hole eats up per unit time. And it's really important for us to understand this because we would like to know what is the underlying mass accretion rate. So far, we don't know. And the simulations will be able to address this. We would like to understand how does the radiation pressure mess up the structure of the accretion flow. Again, so far we don't know this. Does radiation pressure cause powerful outflows? Does the ultraluminous X-ray sources that we think can host intermediate mass black holes do contain intermediate mass black holes? If we know how the radiation is produced in these flows, we will be able to infer the properties of black holes, including mass and spin. Using spectrum variability and other measures like the integrated luminosity, we will be able to measure these masses and spins. And finally, there are two other very important observational puzzles that I didn't mention in this talk, but they are burning to be explained, understood and explained, are what causes spectral state transitions in accretion flows. Because disks sometimes change their thickness, and during the state transitions, they produce powerful transient jets whose nature is not understood. We think that radiation pressure plays an important role there, and it's really important to try and incorporate all the physics that we know and see if we can get the same behavior in our computational lab. Finally, it's thought that radiation-dominated disks are unstable thermally. There were studies that suggested that they're stable, but it's not a final word. And if you're interested, come and talk to me. But implementing radiation in general relativity will be able to answer this unambiguously. Thank you so much. This is I would love it to be a hot debate. People are starting to pick up the mad idea and they start writing papers. So we actually now have competitors. Before that, there were no competitors, so it was great. So whatever I tell you would have to be still verified because it's a really new accretion state that whose study is now reignited by our work. But I would say that the most powerful jets from the quasars that accrete near Eddington, they have got to be MADS. Also, there are quasar analogs that produce powerful jets, so-called FR1 galaxies at lower mass accretion rates, those like M87. I would say that my bet is that that's also a MAD. However, in order to prove that it is a MAD, what do you need to do? Well, you need to either measure the magnetic fields and say, aha, they are very dynamically important, or you need to measure mass accretion rate and the jet power accurately and say, aha, the efficiency is, let's say, greater than 100%, then it will be consistent with the prediction of a MAD. However, the error bars on both of these measurements are quite large. So what you get is, as I mentioned, 100% plus minus a factor of few at least. So if you say, aha, it's a MAD, it's 100% or so, I agree with you. But if you say, no, it's 100% plus minus 50% or 80%, as some people say, then if it's 20%, it could be consistent with what people were doing before. So it's up in the air. The smoking gun could be this event that I showed you, this tidal disruption event, where there are at least five different seemingly unrelated aspects that are explained by the MAD idea. And I'm really happy to get into the details. But really, it's more source by source. And in terms of populations, you would have to convince people that it is this source that is a MAD, that source that is a MAD, and then you can try and go and build up the momentum and see if the whole population is a MAD. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Any more
questions?
So let's ask.